We are in the process of today is the final day of this series that we're doing on John, that I've been calling Final Thoughts. It's Jesus' final thoughts before, his final words to his disciples before he went to the cross. And there is one, I think it's Mark, in the book of Mark, he sums up the whole time. John spends five chapters talking about this. Mark says it in one sentence. I don't know what that says about Mark and what that says about John, but that's quite a difference in how they portrayed this period of time. So what we've seen is we've seen Jesus call the disciples together and set up a Passover dinner and then freak them all out by washing their feet and actually disrupting the dinner that he actually called. In the midst of that dinner, the one who betrays Jesus is revealed. So that was quite exciting. Jesus and the disciples leave the upper room and make their way to the Garden of Gethsemane. And I included in here, I wanted to do, it's hard. This picture at the top is of the city of Jerusalem during Jesus' time. And you can see, you can check out on the right, there are some people standing there. This is actually a model. And if you read the caption, this is a model that was built by a man who built this model in Jerusalem in honor of his son who had died in the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. It was built at a hotel. So he actually constructed this replica of Jerusalem to scale, which is a phenomenal feat. Then they moved it to the Israel Museum, which was a ways away, and broke it down into 1,000 pieces and moved this whole replica to this place that you can go now. And it's got kind of this raised walkway around it. Has anybody ever seen this? Some of you have been to Jerusalem. I didn't know this existed. I would have loved to have seen it because it's hard to get a picture of what Jerusalem was like during that time because it has gone through continual renovation. Some of it was actually burned to the ground in the 70s after Jesus was killed and raised from the dead and went to be with the Father. It was actually the whole place was brought to the ground and then built back up again, brought down through many of the wars that they had and built up. Walls were extended. But this is actually how it looked during Jesus' day. And so you can see in the upper left-hand corner, there's some houses with red roofs. Those were the places where the Roman dignitaries lived. Herod's palace is up there on the top right or left-hand side. And then down below that is the upper room. It's in the top portion. It's like there was in the city of Jerusalem, the white roof houses in the foreground, those were where people lived. And the poorer people lived down the bottom, and then as you go up towards the top is where the richer people lived. And the upper room that this dinner took place in is actually in that top left-hand corner of this picture of Jerusalem. So they went there. Now, you look in the foreground, and you can see the I should say, too, that when I'm describing this, there's a lot of controversy about which gate he went out, which part of the city he went through, where the things were spoken. They're not really even sure where the high priestly prayer, John 17, was that we talked, where he actually prayed that prayer. There are some thoughts about it, and I'm going to share with you some of the thoughts that I have about it. But they made their way down through the city, and in the bottom, on the left-hand side, at the very bottom, well, that section is the Pool of Siloam, where the water was gathered, and then there is a gate there at the bottom, and that's the gate that they think Jesus went out, and he went to the right through the Kidron Valley, which is that little valley that goes up on the right side of Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives was pretty much where those people are standing up the hill from there. So this, what happens during this five chapters in John was, The disciples and Jesus leave the upper room and make their way through the city. There's some people who believe that some of the things that he talked about, like the vine and the branches, there was a place along the way that one of the gates had some big vines that were part of the structure of it. And Jesus may have walked by there and used that as a way to talk about the vine and the branches. There, when he talks about difficult times coming, he could have been walking through a difficult part of town. So this is not like a teaching that Jesus gave in this section. This is him having a conversation with his disciples as he walked along, going from the upper room up to the out the gate of the city and up to the Mount of Olives. Now, the reason why they think that Dung Gate was the gate that he went out of, which is pretty interesting in itself, because they didn't have bathrooms. They took all their waste. It either, this is kind of gross, but it either ran down little troughs outside their houses in the streets, or they took the refuse out this Dung Gate and put it in this valley off to the left. The valley is called the Himnon Valley, which and what they did was they burned it, and so there was continual fires burning in that area. I'm not sure it's because the wind was usually blowing the other way, but I can't imagine. I mean, if you complained about the smell of the mills, that's nothing compared to what we're talking about here. And that was actually the picture of Gehenna. That's where that word comes from, where the picture of hell was all these continual fires burning down in the Himnon Valley. And then on the right side was the Kidron Valley. So the valleys meet about where the Dung Gate was, and that's where they took the refuse out. One of the way that some scholars look at that was Jesus went out the gate where you took everything filthy. And what he was doing is he was walking out carrying the sin of the world on his shoulders. And then went up to the Mount of Olives, was arrested. He was actually brought down exactly the same way he came up, down through the valley and back through the Dung Gate and up to the Herod's palace, which is just actually right above the upper room in this picture. So, and you can see the picture of it down here in this lower diagram. One of the things I would love to see is, you know, some of these things, I'm a visual learner, and so, and also audible. When I have conversations with people, that's usually when I learn the most. And it's not, so I don't, it's hard for me to read and learn that way. I need to see things. And I would love to see this picture of the temple, because it breaks it down if you go online and it shows just that section. And it's amazing how big the courtyard was around the temple, where people would mill around and they'd gather together, especially during this time, which was Passover. And then it's so hard to put yourself in this place. There are disciplines of the Lord, what's it called? Sola lectura, where you're studying the Bible and you're putting yourself in the place of the character. So you pick up a character that's in the Bible and you put yourself in the place of that character and how it would feel to be that character and what they would say and what they would do. And that's always something that's intrigued me. I love the feel of that. I love putting myself in the place of the disciples who were walking there and who were with Jesus during that time. So they went up to this olive grove along the Mount of Olives off to the right, and there was a garden there called Gethsemane, which actually means, what does it mean? Olive garden? No, olive press. And so the place where Jesus went, got down on his knees, prayed to the Father, and took a couple of his disciples with him and said, pray with me, and then he... it was said traditionally that he sweated blood during that time. That was actually in the Garden of Gethsemane, which the name Gethsemane means olive press. And so there's so much symbolism in everything that happens around Jesus. And he didn't try to create it. It was just, part of it was because people realized the significance of what was happening. And it became important to them. Many of you might, you might wonder why we do communion every time we gather. It's not because we feel like we have to, like somebody told us we have to do communion. But there was a time about 12 years ago when we were listening to a teaching from a Jewish teacher, and he was telling us the significance of that, the table. And what I remember most was he said, it's like coming home. It's like coming home. The table's like coming home. So every time we gather together, whether it's on Tuesdays or Sundays, we always receive communion together. And it's not because we're religious. It's because we want to stay as connected with Jesus as we can on every day, kind of every moment. So whenever we gather together in here, we come to the table. There's so much symbolism in this story. I mean, John takes a lot of time and energy to talk about this last night before Jesus went to the cross. And so being a people who are preparing our hearts for what's coming in the earth in this season that we're entering, I think we've already entered it, I want to be ready. I want us to be ready. And it's like, it's so easy to get comfortable. And being a leader in the church over the last 25 years, I've seen a lot of things change. One of the things that's most disturbing is how comfortable we've gotten in just being, I mean, we think that the comfort level that rises up within us when we just go to church, there's a lot of people who don't go to church anymore who are Christians. It doesn't mean they've given up their faith. They just don't go. And part of it is because what we do here on Sundays is so predictable. It's so within the container, within the box, that it's like, you know, I can do this without going to church. And I, my heart is that this becomes a violent place to be. This becomes a place where it's dangerous to be at church. I mean, it could be because at some point, because the government says, enough of this. We're taking away your tax-free status, so that takes away the, you know, most of the revenue of the church. And we're also going to, we believe that you Christians are bigoted, that you don't appreciate the other religions of the world. You're intolerant. And so because you're intolerant, we're going to punish you and say that you cannot meet together. Meet in your homes if you want, but you can't meet together publicly. I don't think we're that far off from that. If you've noticed in the last 5 or 6 years, the whole level of tolerance for Christianity has totally been reversed. At one point, we were on the list of, you know, what was it called? Terrorist watch list. Christians were, because of the bombing of abortion clinics and things like that. And thanks to those folks who seem to demonstrate every time they get an opportunity to tell people that they're going to hell in a handbasket, you know, we have got this reputation where we're the most intolerant group. One of the most tolerant groups is considered to be the Muslims, you know, which is really ironic because things are moving so much that the direction, not, and it's not like I have something against Muslim people at all, but I don't like the way that we've moved away from Christianity, or Christianity has become a target of the government where they say that we're an intolerant people. I think we're some of the most loving, caring, kind people on the earth. Much of the missions work that's done throughout the world is done by Christians. The colleges and university in the United States were started by Christians. Most of the major hospitals in the United States were started by Christians. They were actually churches that developed hospitals and developed places where learning, colleges and stuff like that. But things are changing, and we can't stop that. And I don't think we're supposed to necessarily stop this transition. This transition, if you read the book of Revelation, is part of God's plan. Yeah. And so, you know, we can stand up and we can demonstrate and we can say this should not be this way, but I think we would be better served if we would prepare ourselves for what lies ahead. And the preparation is not drawing arms up, you know, fighting back. The preparation is, are you as close to God as you can possibly be right now? Is he alive in your heart? Is he as alive as he could ever be in your heart right now? Because if this thing unwinds the way it looks like it's going to unwind, people are going to have a lot of questions about who God is and why they should believe in him. So, in the first five verses, I just want to separate one thing out. I don't have really time to break down all of John 17. There's a lot. You can, like, carve it up pretty good, and we'll talk about that just a touch. But I really don't want to do that. I really want to leave it as a whole. John 17 is a conversation between Jesus and his Father. That's what it is. It's not I mean, it's a lot of times called the high priestly prayer because the content of the prayer, the conversation that he has, but it's really a conversation he has with his Father. And I want to look at it that way. So in the first five verses, there's a lot of talk about glory. And I want to look at that just a little bit, what glory means. What is the glory of God? This is what David Wilkerson said. When God gives his glory, he gives himself. He cannot parcel himself out in pieces. No man receives a portion, but all of Jesus. So when he gives his love, you also get his mercy and his holiness and his strength and his justice. When when one receives his mercy, he gets his love and you get the fullness of God. So when we get God, we get the whole package. We don't get him in pieces. There's a song that talks about that that's just been released by Bethel Music called Pieces. And I put the whole thing here because I think it comes out of this whole idea that God doesn't just come and give you a little bit of who he is and then give you a little bit more next week and give you a little bit more next week. That's how we think the more holy we get, the more we're going to get of God. And the reality is our kids that are back in that classroom that are saved have all of Jesus. Same way we have all of him. We have all of who he is. So the song says, unreserved, unrestrained, your love is wild. Your love is wild for me. It isn't shy, it's unashamed. Your love is proud, proud to be seen with me. You don't give your heart in pieces. You don't hide yourself to tease us. And I think that's a lot of times the way Christians look. We got to draw God out. And so he'll, just a second. The cold that won't go away. Uncontrolled, uncontained, your love is a fire burning bright for me. It's not just a spark. It's not just a flame. Your love is a light that all the world will see. All the world will see. That's why I've been so stirred up to let the fire that's inside of us burn. We've got to have a fire inside of us. We can't be burnt out. We can't be a flickering flame. If all of Jesus is in us, then there's a flame, that a significant fire that can burn inside of our hearts. Just as you look at that whole proposition, there's something inside of us that can burn. And then the bridge says, sounds like this: your love's not fractured, it's not a troubled mind, it isn't anxious, it's not the restless kind. Your love is not passive, it's never disengaged. I love that. It's always present, it hangs on every word we say. Love, it keeps its promises, it keeps its word, it honors what is sacred. Because its vows are good. Your love's not broken. It's not insecure. It's not selfish. Your love is pure. The love of God does not come to us in pieces. It comes to us the whole thing. So inside of you, you've got all of God. You've got all of his love. You've got every part of him. You've got as much as you can possibly get. You're not going to somehow get spiritual one day and have all of him. But now you just got peace, a peace. You've got all of him. So when you look at his glory, we got the potential for glory in us all the time. I love what Jack Sawyer said. He said, the term glory is not easy to define, and we're going to see that in just a minute. God's glory is the beauty of his manifold perfections, and together these manifold perfections signify a reality of infinite greatness and worth. I don't even understand that. I mean, it's too big for me to understand. There's too much there. But there's a significance here that we need to get a hold of. Nobody has spent more time. The two people that you look at in history, contemporary and, the last couple hundred years, the two people that talked about glory the most were Jonathan Edwards, who is said to be one of the greatest teachers, not just Christian teachers, but one of the greatest teachers of all time. Remember, Sinner in the Hands of an Angry God, dangling over hell, his sermon that captivated the attention. He wasn't a great orator. He wasn't charismatic at all. He would read his sermons from a paper. He would read them, and people would get struck down. They'd fall in the presence of God, just because he was reading truth. He was expressing truth. He was one of the greatest teachers of glory. The other one is John Piper, who's alive, who's in Minneapolis, Minnesota, something like that. Anyway, he's got a church there. He's one of the great Reformed teachers of our time. And he said this: defining glory is impossible. I say because this like the word beauty, more like the word beauty than basketball. And he goes on to describe, you know, you can tell somebody what a basketball is like. It's round, it's this color, it's either leather or plastic, it's about 9 or 10 inches in diameter. If you drop it, it will come back up. It's bounces, if it's full of air, it will come back up, and you can use it to play a game with, and you can describe it, and people could tell the difference between a football, a baseball, and a basketball by your description. It's easy to describe what a basketball looks like. It's hard to describe glory. He compares it to the word beauty. How do you describe what beauty is? How do you describe beauty? Well, it looks like this, a sunset. It, you know, when I held my grandson today, who I haven't seen in a couple weeks, there's beauty there. His smile lights my heart up. You know, when I look at we were out bike riding yesterday, and it was gorgeous around the lake. Jody said, if you didn't know where you were at and God just plopped you down into this place and put you on a bicycle and you were riding around the lake, you would want to live here forever. It's the most beautiful place. If you didn't have to look at how you got into the city, you know, and you know, it's just it's a beautiful place. And the colors are vibrant right now. You can see the beauty. Glory's kind of like that. Glory's hard to describe. He goes on to say, you can't do that with the word beauty. There are some words in our vocabulary which can communicate, which we can communicate not because we can say them, but because we can see them. We can point. And if we point at enough things and see enough things together and say, that's it, that's it, that's it, we might be able to have a common sense of beauty. But try to put the word beauty into words. It's very, very difficult. And yet, the first five chapters of John 17 are all about glory. And so how do you capture this whole idea? Well, it's not the first time that glory's been center stage. In Moses' encounters with God, he again is captivated by God's glory. His presence in Exodus 33 is riveting. I mean, He goes up to meet with God on his mountain, and the mountain starts erupting, not erupting with lava, but fire and smoke, and it shook, and horns were heard. All kinds of rumbling and thundering were heard on this mountain, just because the presence of God was there. Isaiah saw his glory in Isaiah 6. Was in the year King Uzziah died, and I saw the Lord. He was sitting on a lofty throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Attending him were mighty seraphim, each having six wings, with two wings that covered their. So he's describing this picture of these creatures surrounding the throne of God. Verse 3, they were calling out to each other, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of heaven's armies, the Lord God Almighty. The whole earth is filled with what? Why didn't he say holy? Holiness. The whole earth is filled with his holiness. Holiness, righteousness, that's easy to define. You use the character of God to create a picture of what holiness looks like. But that's not what the whole earth, the whole room was filled with. The whole earth is filled with his glory. That's why I say no matter what's going on in the world around us right now, look at the beauty of creation, you'll see the glory of God. You can see that when we look at each other. When we have God's love in our hearts, we look at each other, we can see God's glory. I can see it in you. And there's a lot of people, I'm just being honest. There's a lot of people, I look into them, I don't see God's glory. I see desperation. I see fear. I see hopelessness. I see a lot of unforgiveness. Nothing will dim the glory of God in a Christian more than not forgiving. When you find somebody, and many of you, you've been here before. You know what it's like to not forgive. You know what it's like to hold a grudge and not forgive. There's something kind of dies inside of you. And then when you forgive, it's like you let go. That's one of the reasons why we forgive, is not for the other person, but because we want to be free. I don't want to be bound by this stuff. So we forgive. But you would expect them to say the whole earth is filled with your holiness. Holy, 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 these creatures are crying. But it says it's filled with his glory. But you can see that in Habakkuk 2. For as the waters fill the sea, the earth is filled with an awareness of the glory of God. Just being aware that his glory is all around us. And then in Ezekiel 10, the cherubim were standing at the south end of the temple when a man went in, and the cloud of glory filled the inner courtyard. Then the glory of the Lord rose from above the cherubim and went over the door of the temple. The temple is filled with this cloud of glory. And it reminds me of, you know, when the sky is filled. I saw a picture, a video of what they called the glory cloud in Africa during one of the big gatherings. And it looked like a rainbow. In fact, you could see a double rainbow in this picture. But there was something, you know, the rainbow, the arc is here. There's something down in this area that was phenomenal going on. It was a brightness, a piercing brightness, the glory. And everybody was pointing to it and saying, glory, 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 glory. And you could easily say it was just a rainbow. But something was going on powerfully for these people. The glory of the Lord was visible to thousands of people all at once. Glory, God's glory captivates our attention. So it's two things. It's the magnitude of who he is, and also this brilliant light that shines out. I think that you hear people talk about near-death experiences. What do they talk about? Walking toward what? Walking toward the light. And there's this person, I could hardly make him out, but it was just the brightest light, the purest light, and all I felt was what? What do they say? Love. That's the glory of God. Jesus in his glorified state, he can't help it. He just is that way. He's all brightness. His goodness and his brightness shine. And that's actually in us. That's available in us. It dwells within us. I don't know how we keep it under wraps so well, except that I think it's part of God's plan, this unwinding, to begin to let it out more and more and more. I think we're going to see it more in each other. And we really need each other to encourage that. So if you look at the context of this, of John 17, I mean, there's lots of people that break it down. There's a guy, I just put this, I'm not going to talk about it, but somebody said that it was like concentric circles. But in verses 1 through 5, Jesus talks about himself or prays for himself. In verses 6 through 19, he prays for his disciples. And then 20 through 26, he expands it to pray for those who would believe through his disciples, you know, that kind of thing. So you can look at it that way. Alistair Begg, who's a phenomenal teacher from Scotland or Ireland? Scotland. He breaks it down into four words. 1 through 5 is glory. 6 through 19 is preservation. 17 and 18 is talking about sanctification. Then unity in 20 through 26, which that all makes sense. It makes sense to me anyway. But I think it's also one of the contexts you can look at it is in relationship. I think you could look at this whole John 17 and really get the picture that it's more about relationship than anything else. It's very different. I mean, earlier in the Gospels, the disciples come to Jesus and they say, teach us how to pray. What does he do? He kind of gives them a model, the Lord's Prayer. You know, he gives them a model. Why didn't he do that here? It's the last night he was with them. Why didn't he give them a model? Why didn't he say, this is how you pray? I think that's because relationship is important to him. Let me show you what I mean. I need 11 disciples. Come on, Jim, Patrick, come on up. 11 of you. Somebody count. Who wants to be a disciple? Come on.
I'll break the rule.
There we go.
I'll break the rule.
How many we have?
This is the girl's side.
Two more.
We need two more?
There's one.
Come on up. We need one more. Do you notice how Christian this is? Yeah, go invade their side. Is there 12?
I am his Jesus.
No, I'm Jesus. I always wanted to be. No. So we got 11? So let's go over here.
I'm his favorite.
Well, let's go over to the dung gate. Come on over here. Come on. Disciples, get your act together.
It's hard for us to do that.
So we've been up in the upper room, us buds. Did you notice how they all lined up in a line up here? Isn't that so sweet? They're even in a line now. I don't think this is the way it worked. I think that the disciples wanted to be really close. John was like holding on to Jesus' shirt tail, you know. And Peter was, I hope I don't screw up. I hope I just don't let me screw up again. I can't handle this anymore. But they were in the upper room, had all this stuff happen, and then they began to make their way to the Mount of Olives, which is over there where Katie's standing. And so they've got this journey. It's only like a 20-minute walk. It's maybe 10 minutes to get through the city, although it's at night. So there's actually only one gate you can go in and out of in Jerusalem at night, and that's this gate. It's because it's a real narrow gate.
The doo-doo gate.
The doo-doo gate. And there's some question about whether it was actually that gate or not, but it was a real narrow gate, so you couldn't get a group of people in and out. You had to go in out single file. That's how they kept track of people. So Jesus looks like head over there. We're heading over to... And they're just walking. And he stops along the way. And you guys are not... Jesus didn't have one of these mics. So you'd have to stay up here close. You know? Now this is not a small group of people. It would be obvious that something was going on with people, right? It was Passover. This looks like a motley crew. Joan.
I'm not the best looking one here.
So they're walking and they're listening to Jesus. And so they're like really close to him and kind of crowding around him. And so they're walking up to the Mount of Olives. Come with me. And so somewhere in the middle, Jesus just stops and he looks up. And he starts talking to his father. He doesn't say, let's all bow our heads. We're going to pray now. Or I'm going to pray to my dad. You guys just be patient. It's like he's been modeling stuff all night for these guys. He's been looking at them, talking to them. He's been, you know, there was a betrayer in his midst. He washed their feet. He made them uncomfortable. You know, the whole thing with Peter denying him, the stuff he said about the future, it's all part of this conversation he's having with him. And then all of a sudden he just stops somewhere in the Kidron Valley, probably, somewhere in the valley outside the city. All the commotion's inside the walls and there's not much going on out here. And he just looks up and he says, Father, my time has come. Unveil the glorious splendor of your Son so that I will magnify your glory. Glory's all throughout this. You have already given me authority over all people so that I may give the gift of eternal life to all those whom you've given me. And I think he was like looking at these guys, saying this. I don't think he had his eyes on heaven the whole time. In this first part, yes, he looked up because he wanted them to see that he was talking to his father. But then I think he wandered around and he looked at these people and he would speak right to them. He'd say these things to his disciples. Eternal life means to know and experience you. He's just talking to the Father. He's not being distracted by these people who are listening to him and watching him. He keeps talking to the Father. Eternal life means to know you and experience you as the only true God and to know and experience Jesus Christ as the Son whom you've sent. He's talking about himself now. I've shown you the world your glory by faithfully doing everything you've told me to do. So, my Father, restore me back to the glory which we shared when we were face to face before the universe was created. He's saying that to his dad. He's saying, restore me back to that place where we were before all this was created. And he was saying it to these guys. Father, he was looking at them and talking to his father. And then it kind of switches. Now he's talking to them. Father, I have manifested who you really are, and I've revealed you to men and women who you gave me. They were yours and you gave them to me, and they have fastened your word firmly to their hearts. And he's talking to these people. These are his disciples. These are the ones who he has been mentoring and discipling for this past couple years. They've been walking with him. They know everything that he's done. They've been with him. And now at last, they know everything I have is a gift from you. So every word that Jesus is saying to his disciples is a prayer to his Father, but it's important to all these guys. He's preparing them right now. It's a prayer, yes, but he's preparing them by the things that he's saying. And the very words you gave me to speak, I've passed on to them. And I'm sure that Peter was going, oh no, there's going to be a test. I'm never going to remember this. And then he thinks, oh yes, but he told me the Holy Spirit was going to be given to us to help us remember. This is a very personal thing. This is not a bunch of people who are kind of milling around, you know, like grabbing sticks and throwing rocks. And they're intently paying attention to what Jesus was sharing with them. Listen to his words to them. They have received your words and can carry them in their hearts. They are convinced that I come from your presence, and they have fully believed that you sent me to represent you. So with deep love, I pray for my disciples. So he's taken this prayer, that's this conversation, what's going on, and now he's having a conversation with the disciples. So he's talking to them. And he's not just talking, but he's praying as he looks at them. His eyes are open. His eyes are open as he's praying this, looking at his disciples. They are convinced that I came from your presence, and they have fully believed that you sent me to represent you. So with deep love, I pray for my disciples. I'm not asking on behalf of the unbelieving world that's inside that city behind the walls up behind them. It's not them that I'm praying for, but for those who belong to you, who you've given to me. For all who belong to me now belong to you. And all who belong to you belong to me as well. And my glory is revealed through their surrendered lives. And I imagine some of them were, their knees are getting weak at this point. He's talking to us. He's talking about us. He's talking to God about us right now. Holy Father, again, he's talking to God. Holy Father, I'm about to leave this world and return to you, but my disciples will remain here. So I ask that by the power of your name, you protect each one of them. Each one you've given me, and watch over them so that they will be united as one, even as we are united as one. While I was with these, you gave me. It's like uncomfortable, right? It would take about 3.5 minutes to read this prayer. Jesus is having this conversation with his disciples for probably about 5 minutes. He's talking to them, talking to the Father, talking to them. It's very personal. And now he talks about protecting them. If I could find my place in Jesus' prayer. Now I'm returning to you, Father, so I pray that they'll experience and enter into my joyful delight in you that has fulfilled them and overflows. I have placed your word within them, and that's why the unbelieving world hates them. And they're like, what? This is serious. Somebody's going to hate us for this? Somebody's going to despise us for this? For their allegiance is no longer to this world because I'm not of this world. I'm not asking that you remove them from the world, and they're like, but I ask you to guard their hearts from evil. And he wasn't talking about bad days. There is a devil. There is, the evil one is real and alive, and he's real and alive today. And Jesus was telling his disciples, the evil one is real. And you heard about and you saw how he tempted me. He's going to tempt you too. Guard their hearts from evil that they no longer belong to this world. Don't worry, Jesus is almost finished. Then he says, your word is truth. So this is all about sanctification. Your word is truth. Make them holy. Make them holy by your truth. I've commissioned them to represent me. And I think he would look at his disciples and say, I have commissioned you to represent me. I've commissioned them to represent me. He's already gone. Judas has already left.
Oh, sorry, I missed that.
He's going to meet him on the top of the hill. But that's why there's 11, because he's already out of the picture. But yeah, that was pretty intense in the room at that time too. I pray for them all to be joined together as one, even as you and I, Father, are one. I pray for them to become one with us. And this is, so he's entering this, now it's extending out to other people. And he's telling them, this isn't just about you. I mean, really, this isn't just about you, but what you do and what you say and how you live your lives in the days ahead is going to change the world. Everything about the world is about to change, because I'm going to go to the cross and die there. I'm going to be raised from the dead, but you're going to be on the earth as my representatives. And I ask only for these not only for these disciples, but for those who will one day believe in me through their message, which is us. He's talking, Jesus is talking to the Father about you and I, right here. For the very glory you've given to me, I have given to them. So he says, I've given them the glory so that they will be joined together as one and experience the same unity we enjoy. You live fully in me and I live fully in them. And I can just see Jesus just speaking to them. You live, Father, you live fully in me and I live fully in them. I'm fully in them. So that they will experience perfect unity in the world and be convinced that you have sent me. For they will see that you love each one of them with the same passionate love that you have for me. Father, I ask that you allow everyone you've given me to reign at our side. So it's not going to be just about what happens here. You're going to be with me forever. For I want them to be with me where I am. And Jesus, because he's eternal, this isn't just about this time, or it isn't just about eternity. It's about all time. Wherever I am, I want them to be with me. Right now, Jesus is here. He's in us. We're with him where he is. So this conversation that's going on with God is very real to Jesus. Then they will see my full glory, the very splendor you have placed upon me because you have loved me even before the beginning of time. Then he ends it by saying this, you are my righteous Father, but the unbelieving world has never known you in the perfect way that I know you. And he's saying that to his disciples. And all of those who believe in me also know that you've sent me. I've given them the revelation of who you are, and I will continue to make you even more real to them. And Jesus knows what's coming. He knows what he's about to do. He knows he's going to go to the cross, and his death is going to be traumatic for these people he's talking with. Again, it's a conversation with the Father, but it's real, it's alive, it's true. He's going to the cross, but he's going to be raised in 3 days too. And he knows the glory that's going to come with that. And he knows the powerful message it's going to send to these people who are standing around him. I've given them the revelation of who you are, and I will continue to make you even more real to them so they may experience the same endless love that you have for me. For your love will now live in them, even as I live in them. And Jesus turns around and walks. And they're like, what just happened? I mean, is this, he told us how to pray. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, with our eyes closed and heads bowed. But no, now he has this prayer that he's praying with his disciples, which is real. It's alive. He's talking to the Father with them in their midst. You guys can have a seat. Thank you for being such faithful disciples. I think it's remarkable, John 17. Like it says up here above, Jesus' high priestly prayer is only about 650 words. It takes about 3 minutes and 30 seconds to read aloud, but will take all eternity for us to fully understand. I think it's something that's going, we're going to remind ourselves of it in the days ahead. I think in some ways, if you're going to memorize a portion of Scripture, that John 17 would be the most important section of Scripture to memorize, to have in your heart, to have in your memory, to be able to recite without having to look at a book. Because what if the books are taken away? What if we can't go to our PDA, our phone, or our tablet, or whatever? What if all we can depend on is what we know to be true? I think that this chapter, this conversation between Jesus and his Father that is overheard by his disciples, is one of the most powerful sections of Scripture there is. Because you see relationship lived out. Jesus doesn't tell them, like, you want to know how to pray? This is the information that you need to know. He's not giving them information. He's giving them his relationship with the Father. He's sharing his relationship with the Father with them. And isn't that the way we want to live our lives? I don't want to preach at people. I don't want to try to get people saved. I don't want to have altar calls and count the number of people that come up and then have them sign up for a class later. I want their hearts to be changed. And this gives me hope. This John 17 gives me hope that it doesn't have to be religious. It can be real. Our relationship with him can be real. That we can preach not just with our words, but like beauty, with the way that we look and sound and feel. When people say, I want to be, I don't know what it is about you, but I want to be around you. People say that about you. They say that about me. There are people who want to be with us. And I think it's partly because what happened in John 17 is happening in our lives to some extent. But we need more. We need more of this. We need to have this kind of a relationship where we can talk to God and talk to people at the same time. And they don't even know which is which. Next time you go to pray for somebody, try this. Next time you pray for healing for somebody, instead of saying, Lord, you know, and bowing your head and closing your eyes and getting all serious and religious. And Lord, you can do this. I know you can do this. I'm asking you to do this. Now do this. Just look at the people. And speak Jesus into their lives. Release Jesus. Release who he is to you. That's why we need this fire burning inside of us, because it's got to be real. It can't be hypocritical. We can't tell them that Jesus is going to heal them and then walk up and go, I hope that happens. I don't know if this is possible, but, you know. Have you ever prayed for the dead to be risen? You know, Jeff has. Kim? Nancy? Yeah, if you're in the medical field, you get opportunities to do this because you're around dead people. And I know that feeling of having somebody, a corpse in front of you, and saying, oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus, do you want this person? Is it time? Or is it time for this to be? Yep. When was the last time you did it, Jeff? 2 weeks? Come here. Why don't you come up and share with people what it's like? We're almost done. Jeff is an EMT, so he gets the opportunity to be around dead people. Which is, you have to. If you're going to raise the dead, you got to be around dead people.
What do I share? Just the experience?
Yeah. Tell them what happened. There you go.
Check, check, check.
There it is. Well, it was probably early 60s, late 50s-year-old male patient. His spouse had found him in the house, and they were upset. Obviously, I would be really upset too. And we went in and we did all of our thing, and it didn't work out. And so he was just laying.
So you tried to resuscitate him?
Yeah, we tried. We did CPR, we intubated, we did all the stuff that we do. And it didn't work out. They called the doctor, and the doctor said, you can go ahead and, you know, quit efforts. And so we did. And as we were cleaning up all the stuff.
So what's going through your head at this time?
What's going through my head? Through my head, I'm thinking like, well, because I've been, I don't know, for the last year or so, I've been really trying to do this resurrection thing. and it's rough. I mean, it's rough because it's I mean, like, you know, praying for a headache to go away, we all try that out. But but for someone who's got no heartbeat and who's not breathing and is white, that's dead on the floor, that's another different level of, like, hey, let's give this a shot. And so, anyway, so we're cleaning up afterwards, and I gave it a little go for it.
So what was the conversation like going in your head?
This is my thing.
Between you and Jesus.
Honestly, for me, I'm just thinking, like, this guy's too young. I know Jesus went around healing everyone he came in contact with, like, everyone he came. So I was like, and he didn't come to kill, to steal, or destroy. And a dad a dad and a husband was killed, you know, a family was destroyed, and a life was stolen. And so I'm like, this isn't God. That's just my heart. And so I'm just like, I don't really fight with it. Was it God's will that he died or not? That's kind of not what I'm going with. I'm just going with, like, the family doesn't have a dad anymore. So let's work on that.
And so it's compassion that was moving you. Yeah. Not necessarily a word from the Lord.
Not a word from the Lord. Just me. Just trying. Because, I don't know, we're supposed to signs that follow those who believe. And so I just, that's it. That's what's going through my mind. And I prayed once.
Did you pray out loud?
First time I did not.
I'm not trying to.
No, you're fine. No, it's okay. You
but
can ask
I
me
just
questions.
Want, there's Get a it. Conversation going on.
There is. Well, I'm thinking like, well, and then not only that, there's three police officers. There's eight fire guys. There's family members and other people in the apartment complex and my partner and me. And so I'm just like, you know, I give it one of these like, hey, Lord, come on. You know, even while they were doing CPR on him, I put my hand on his stomach and I prayed for him.
Yeah.
And we did that. And then that didn't work and we called it. And then as we were cleaning up. So I probably actually literally prayed about three times. Mm-hmm. First time was why we were going for it. Like, hey, God, you know, come on, do this thing. And really it was like, I just speak life back into this man in the name of Jesus.
Yeah.
That's what I would do. It was like, I just command life into this man. That's pretty much my prayer. And then I didn't realize it, but then I was kind of praying out loud and in front of the people. And they're like, sorry. It was like, and then when it cleared out, kind of, I did it again, louder. So that's it. That's all my experience.
Would it have been weird at that point to say, just out loud to yourself, I want to know what I'm supposed to be doing now? You know, I want to know, is this time for a prayer, Lord? You know, I'm not saying you should have done that, Jeff, but it's right in front of you. All this stuff is right in front of you. There's somebody who's not alive who you think could be brought back to life. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you so much. I think that we have to be real about this thing. Jeff is one of the most real people I know. You can tell by just the way he talks. It's like he doesn't think he's like this higher, holier-than-thou person, but he's just one of the guys. That's the way we need to be in this world right now. You know, some of you are getting your voice back. You're getting your voice back. We're almost done. Be patient for just a sec. You're getting your voice back. You're not getting your voice back so that you can preach on Sundays. This is not the goal, is to have my job. You don't want this job. The goal in getting your voice back is not public speaking. The goal in getting your voice back is a conversation with God, like Jesus was having with his Father. The goal of getting our voice is so that we can have conversations with God and conversations with people. And sometimes it's really hard to tell the difference. It really is. So that's what he's training us for. That's what he's releasing us into. Let's stand. Let's